right club. Be the right club today. Yes!
Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!
Expect anything different?
All right, welcome back, everybody, to the No Laying Up podcast. We have another new guest for you this time, first time on the podcast, Grantland golf writer Shane Ryan. Shane, would you say you are in, all right, so we're recording this on Thursday, August 28th. Are you in Ryder Cup mode or are you in FedEx Cup playoff mode?
Yeah, I'm totally in Ryder Cup mode, man. I mean, I wish the PGA Tour people have been so nice to me, so I wish I could say FedEx Cup. Now, I'm doing a Grantland piece that's coming out tomorrow, which, you know, is Friday. It's about, you know, what's going to happen on Tuesday with the Ryder Cup picks. And one thing I was thinking is, like, you know what? We don't have in golf, we don't have a draft. We don't have a trade deadline. We don't have, like, we don't care if a golfer comes out early from college. We don't really have retirements because dudes play on the senior tour forever. Tuesday is our only, like, off-the-course day. Like captain's picks are it, basically. That's our one, like, you know, like, off-season or off-the-course thing that we can get psyched about.
That's a great point. I've never thought of that. Well, we had an idea back in the spring for that when the match play future was very much up in the air. We wrote a thing, which you probably haven't seen, about how the players should have a sort of draft for the Accenture match play or whoever the new sponsor is for the match play. Basically, you get seated 1 through 64, and I won't go into the details of it, but it would be televised on the Golf Channel. You tune in on a Tuesday night, so all the during practice, you wouldn't know who you were playing, and you essentially got to choose your playing partner. How much more interesting would the match play be if that was the case, if you got to call out individual opponents?
See, I mean, that is such a good idea, and I've heard a modified version of that for the Ryder Cup where one captain is like, okay, number one, we're leading with Phil Mickelson, and the Euro captain goes, all right, fair enough, Victor Dubuisson against him, and we're going to go number two, Justin Rose. And then the American captain comes back and says, I mean, it would be like, yeah, and like the same thing for your Accenture idea. It's so good. And it's like, why wouldn't they do that? I mean, it'd be so much fun. Everybody would tune in. It would be great.
Like Phil would show up with just a binder full of data on every player. And he'd be going through their crunching numbers as they go through the draft and whatnot. Like that, just like the fantasy football guy you play with that takes it way too seriously. It's like, it would be infinitely hilarious. Like, there's no way I would miss that, if they covered that live on the Golf Channel.
Well, it would be so much drama, too. Like nobody likes Patrick Reed, so would everyone beat him, or would everybody just avoid him till the end? Would everybody avoid Poulter? You know, like, things like that. Like, when it was Bubba's turn, like, who would he pick? You know, like, it would be awesome.
Yeah. Well, they do, your idea for the matchups, they do that for the President's Cup, right? They sit down in front of each other and kind of, like, there's not really a clock, and I remember Fred Couples putting a name up on the board, and Nick Price had to match it, and Nick Price put a name up on the board, Fred Couples matches. I don't know why they wouldn't do that with the Ryder Cup. I mean, that would add a whole new level of strategy, especially come Sunday.
I will say, though, that I think I would like that, and I think in the end I would choose that if I had the option, but there's something cool, too, about the blind selection of, like, because it lends more strategy to the captain's picks, because they can think, like, all right, who are they going to put out first? If, you know, if they're going to put their top gun, do I want to waste somebody? Like, do I want to put, I don't know who the waste pick at the U.S. team would be, like Zach Johnson or someone, like, you know, throw him out there and then throw my, like, top guns out at the end. So it's kind of fun to see how that lines up once they do that, too.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, I think it was my friend Adam Sarson, he and I were talking this week. Tiger's never had, like, a good Sunday singles match. He always gets paired up with, like, Andrew Coulthard or Jesper Parnevik or something on Sunday. And it's just, it's amazing how it's all fallen out. Like, you know, the best match I remember him having was, I think it was, did he play Ernie Els in that President's Cup where they tied, or just in the playoffs that he just went and played against Ernie Els, decide the President's Cup, like the 03 President's Cup or something like that.
Yeah, I'm not a President's Cup scholar.
Yeah,
so I'm not...
no one really is. I don't know why I brought that question up. It's not the best topic of discussion, especially when we're a month away from the Ryder Cup.
It brings up an interesting question of, like, you know, Team World in the President's Cup is no worse than Team Europe. I mean, there's a ton of great players. There's no reason the President's Cup shouldn't be as awesome as the Ryder Cup, except for I guess, like, history and tradition, right? I mean, that's the only thing, that's the only difference.
Yeah, it's just the rivalry isn't there. I mean, it's not, first, it's not been competitive enough. The internationals have not made it nearly competitive enough in the short history that the event's been there. And it's just a cheap play off the Ryder Cup. I mean, it is just, I mean, the Ryder Cup, I can't explain how excited I get for it. I mean, I told myself, I've been telling myself all year about how big a favorite Europe is. And it's some, there's, I haven't picked a day yet, but I'm going to flip the switch where I stop being so negative and I just turn my attention towards rooting for the United States. And looking at, the more I look at it, though, the further I keep pushing that day back. Like, I can't, I just can't picture it. I pictured a little bit better than I did maybe a month ago, but, and just in looking, just every time I pull up that European team page and the U.S. team page and look at how the U.S. guys are playing. Granted, it's been better, but I just can't be confident, you know, in a team that's bringing Bubba Watson over as the number one player on foreign soil when the guy can't hit a shot without being distracted on a Friday at Ridgewood Country Club in a FedEx Cup event. Like, there's going to be an international incident with Bubba Watson.
Here's the thing, though. Yeah, I totally agree. No, Bubba Watson is not going to understand Europe at all. He's going to embarrass himself somehow. But the thing that I love about this U.S. team is it's just such a group of oddballs. So you got Bubba, who's like, you know, the world's biggest narcissist. Like, he is like a total head case. Then you've got Jimmy Walker, who's kind of like this nerd who has like a laboratory in the Southwest where he takes photos of stars and he's been in National Geographic. Then you have like Zach Johnson, crazy, like extreme Christian, right? Like the ultimate like Christian dude. Patrick Reed, who nobody likes. Kuchar, who everybody likes. And we're only going into, you know, Mickelson, who's like kind of his own weird breed of lunatic. Like, this is like the Dirty Dozen or something. Like, I am so excited for this team because I think against all odds, I think they have a chance to pull through. And my only hope is that Tom Watson keeps the weirdness going with his captain's picks. Like, I hope he doesn't go with like Snedeker and Stricker or whoever. I hope it's like Brendan Todd and Hunter Mahan and Keegan Bradley. So we have, you know, an OCD guy in there, you know, a guy in Brendan Todd who looks like he's a computer programmer. Like, I hope it just goes along. I want this team as weird as possible.
And you left out Jim Furyk, too. It's just a whole other wrinkle in there. I mean, it is. There's no camaraderie between any of these guys on this team when you think about it. And, I mean, yeah, it's the chalkiest subject, and everyone has their own opinion here, but who do you think are the three going to be the three captains pick? Who would you take if you were Tom Watson?
Yeah, okay, so this is the subject of the story I'm writing in Granville tomorrow, so I'll give you a
spoiler
sneak preview, although by the time it comes out, it probably won't be a sneak preview, but I think Hunter Mahan is a great pick, and I think he's going to pick him. Yeah. I think Hunter, you know, we all know we had the little chip against Graham McDowell that lost the Ryder Cup in 2010, but this guy also had an 11-match win streak at the Accenture Match Play, and I think it was like 169 holes that he had never trailed in the match play match in that tournament. He's a tough dude. I mean, he's a guy who I think will win a major someday. His game's really great right now, and he's going to have a lot to play for. So I would pick him. I think he's going to pick him. I think unless he misses the cut this week, we'll probably see Keegan Bradley. Because Keegan Bradley, you know, he paired so well with Phil Mickelson, at least in Medina he did. And he's a good putter and everything like that. I think Bradley, he's going to pick him, and it's a good pick. The third pick is a really curious one. He could go to Snedeker, which I think would be a terrible pick. Webb Simpson would be kind of the safe pick because, you know, we know he can play under pressure because he's got a major championship. His form's okay right now. And he's got experience in the sense that he played one other Ryder Cup. I guess it could go to Stricker. I feel like that's becoming less and less of a possibility, so I don't think that's actually going to happen. My guy and the guy I would pick is Brendan Todd. I don't think Watson's going to pick him, but the dude can straight putt and chip. I mean, he's among the best in the tour at those two things, which is so valuable. He doesn't have any experience. He never won a major. He won his first tournament this year. Never been in a Ryder Cup, but I would love to see him pick Brendan Todd. I would guess Webb Simpson, though, is going to be Watson's third pick.
I'm going to surprise you. I am completely on board for Brendan Todd. I was so relieved to hear somebody else say that. I've been actually saying that since about You know, when he finished top 10 at the Memorial is when I was fully convinced. Because when he won the Byron Nelson, I specifically wrote, I was like, here we go, another crazy random winner on the PGA Tour this year, another Stephen Bowditch. Like, I don't think we're looking at the next superstar. And he actually surprised me more after he won. He finished tied for 5th at Colonial, tied for 8th at Memorial, 17th at U.S. Open, and then had top 5s at the Quicken Loans and the Greenbrier after that. I was like, all right, I was sold on Brendan Todd. He's been struggling a little bit since then. I guess really since mid-July. I've got him looking at his page now. He's not really, he has finished better than tied for 39th since July. But that's another question I have that I wouldn't have asked probably 2 weeks ago. But I just started reading Mark Brody's book, Every Shot Counts. And it kind of have you read it at all? Have you heard about it?
No, I've heard about it, but I've not read it yet.
So the crux of it is that. Well, first of all, I just realized how dumb a lot of the things I say about the game of golf are. Like, I always said about the Ryder Cup, man, you need guys that make putts. And, like, I'm literally 25% into the book, and I'll never say that again just because it's just it doesn't make a lot of sense. Like, and I think especially in the Ryder Cup, it's kind of a cliche. Like, everyone has their own opinion on what the specialty is for a Ryder Cup player. Like, oh, you need somebody with length, or, oh, you need somebody that's going to make putts. But I think, if anything, the Ryder Cup is the best example of somebody that you need a good all-around game because you can't hide any part of your game in alternate shot. Like, you can't.
No.
You know what I mean? So, well, is there a typical prototype player that you look for? That, you know, so we're talking about Brendan Todd, who has no experience in the event. I do think experience matters on an international Ryder Cup. But is there anything in particular that you, a new skill in particular that you favor, I guess?
Well, let me say this about experience first, because this is like, that's a little bit of a pet peeve of mine. You look at guys, so in 2012, Davis Love had 4 captain's picks, and it was, you know, Jim Furyk, Steve Stricker, Brent Snedeker, and I think Dustin Johnson was his 4th captain's pick. Now, combination of young and old, Snedeker at that point had not played one, and Dustin Johnson had experience, but his 2 quote-unquote experienced guys were Jim Furyk and Steve Stricker.
Mm-hmm.
However, at that point, the U.S. had lost 6 of 8 Ryder Cups. So I think at some point we have to say, what does that mean? What does experience mean? In the case of the U.S., it is completely negative experience.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like it's terrible records. Like Jim Furyk's record is really abysmal. I think he's won 33% of his matches in Ryder Cup, which is real bad. Stricker the same way. You know, Furyk, we know kind of, he won a major in 2003, he won the U.S. Open, but he kind of struggles under pressure. We know Stricker really struggles under pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, well, what does experience mean? So for the Europeans, experience means Ian Poulter, Lee Westwood, Sergio, guys who have, like, really, really positive experience in the Ryder Cup, and that's great. But for the U.S., experience, I don't think it's necessarily a plus. And so,
go ahead.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, no, no. I mean, I just think that's like, it's something that I keep hearing from the media, and it's like, yeah, experience is good, but only, I feel like it's only as good as the actual experience is. People are treating Steve Stricker right now like this, like, icon of the game, and it's like, wait a second, like hold up a second, you know? Or Brent Snedeker, they're like, oh, Snedeker's got experience. Well, no, he blew a foursomes match in 2012, and every time this guy's been, you know, in contention in a major, he shoots 80. You know what I mean? Like
yep.
I don't know if that's the kind of experience you want. Now, I agree that first timers, the pressure is going to be like nothing they've ever felt before. But when you have a generation in the U.S. that has absolutely known almost nothing except failure, like really, it's like, is experience that much of a thing? Do we really want to? Like, is that the ingredient we really care about at this point?
I agree. I'm with you here. I really am. I think if you have enough sample data to show somebody's extensive experience and their amount of suckitude is that of Jim Furyk, like, that's not a positive thing. Like, Furyk's career record in 4-ball is 1-8-1. Like, if he plays 4-ball, he can't play 4-ball. That's a huge sample. You can't put him out there. I don't care how good he's playing. I know Watson's going to, but like, there's no way I would line him up in 4-ball. I just could not play him out there. I think alternate shot fits him a lot better than a four ball mentality does. But I just feel like that shock of being on the first tee, if you played in the event at least once, I think that matters to me. Like, especially for a captain pick, like
mm-hmm.
I feel like you need to have been there. That's why I don't think he's going to take Todd. I think Todd is a better option than Webb Simpson. I think I agree. I think Mahan's going to go be one, Keegan two for captain's picks, and that's probably what I would do as well. That third spot, I think I would lean towards Todd, but I think it's going to be Snedeker. I know I spoke with Shane Bacon of Yahoo about this a couple weeks ago, just about Watson and, you know, Snedeker have that RBC tie. Like, I don't know how good of friends they are, but they have a relationship. It's clear they have a working relationship. I think that kind of familiarity, would they get some pressure from RBC to pick, you know, Snedeker? I don't see him making any shocking moves, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think they're definitely pals, right? But I don't think you can necessarily pressure Tom Watson at this point in his career. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, I don't know if you can swear on your podcast, but the I don't give a blank fact Watson has got to be, like, sky high, you know? I mean, and, yeah, I guess Snedeker's form is not so good right now. It's fine, and it's probably better than Todd's, but I don't think it's so good that you necessarily, like, just take him, you know, without question, because when is this guy? So Watson, when he did his press conference after the PGA Championship, the Monday after, said, you know, what are we going to consider, all this stuff, but then the last thing he said, he's like, I want to emphasize the gut factor. We're going to pick guys with like, strong guts who can make these shots under pressure. I don't see anything about Snedeker that leads you to believe that he has the gut factor at all. That's what I'm saying. Like, I don't know what you can expect from this guy under pressure. And if you don't think you can expect anything from him, I don't know. Like, why would you pick him? You know what I mean? Pick Webb Simpson. Maybe Brendan Todd's too green or whatever. But I don't know. Snedeker to me is just like it's just such a conservative loser pick in some ways.
Yeah, the problem with that is you what you're saying about the gut factor. There's no one knocking on the door that really feels like has that gut factor, whatever that means. It's not like Harris English is really battle tested and we know how he's going to handle the pressure, or Ryan Moore is going to step up to a putt and we think he's going to make it as well. So that's just where it's the lack of enthusiasm from the chances of the U.S. team comes from on my end. So yeah, I'm with you though. It's going to be fun. I can't wait. I really can't. I was looking at what's interesting. The TV schedule this year, I mean, I live in Chicago, I live in the Central Time Zone. It starts at 1:30 on Friday morning. Like, what is my strategy? What is your strategy for watching? Like, do I come home Thursday night from work and go to sleep for 6 hours and then wait, get some coffee going and get going at 1:30, or what's the plan?
Yeah, I mean, well, look, I'm in a big time here. I'll be in Scotland, so I'm not gonna...
Oh, man.
Yeah, so... Hey, I don't know. I don't know what you'd be on to in this situation. No, but no, I think if I was home, if I were home, I would say, yeah, I mean, okay, I would say if there's anything that you want to watch live, it's the right.
I'm watching it live. That's not a question. The question is whether or not to stay up all night and watch through the morning or to go to sleep before.
I would try to get some shut-eye before, unless you want to make it an all-night party, but then you run the risk of, like, not having anything in the tank for the, you know, the second round of matches on Friday.
Exactly. And that's actually, I'm moving from Chicago, like, 2 days after the Ryder Cup ends. And so, it's like my last week in Chicago, too, so I have to figure out, I'm already trying to game plan this thing, if you can't tell, like, how I'm going to be in front of a TV to watch all this stuff without being completely exhausted. But
where are you moving to from Chicago?
I'm moving actually to Amsterdam. I'm going on like a rotation with my company for 18 months there. And I wish I was going there 2 weeks earlier. If that was the case, I would have snaggled away to get over to Glen Eagles. That's for sure. But I'm just going to barely miss it.
Totally. Yeah. No. Yeah. I think you're right, man. I think a little nap beforehand is good. And then watch it. And then, yeah, I mean, the Ryder Cup, the minute you hear like that music, you know, I can still hear it in my head. Like, it's just such an amazing event. It's actually the first golf event I ever covered, and the 2012 Ryder Cup that I covered for Grantland, to me, is still the best sporting event, period, any sport that I've ever covered. It was amazing.
It's the best sporting event I've ever attended. I went Friday, and we got there first thing in the morning. We saw the Bubba Watson, Ian Poulter first, which is, it's weird for me to root for Bubba Watson in general at all.
yeah.
I mean, that was the coolest thing I've ever seen in sports, honestly. That first tee where people just screaming USA at 7:08 in the morning or whatever it was, and just launching a tee shot and just everyone going absolutely nuts. I mean, There's so many people around that first tee. We couldn't see anything. So we just kept trying to like leap ahead a couple holes. Finally, we figured out we leaped up, left ahead like five holes, waited on the 15th green, which is the drivable par four. And we waited there like on a hill behind it for an hour and a half for them to come through. And the morning matches, the U.S. won every single one. They won the 15th hole every single time, and they closed the first point there. And that's where Keegan drained that putt, and Pepsi, his caddy, was whipping the flag around his head. I mean, I've never heard of a roar that loud on a golf course. It's chilling. And just watching the Golf Channel's been playing like the greatest rounds, even though it's been U.S. collapse since they've been playing. Just watching it, getting back in Ryder Cup mode, has me completely jacked up.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, no, it was absolutely, the environment was like nothing I ever experienced. I don't know if you guys at the course, did you have the little radios where you could listen to the BBC feed?
I don't remember if it was the BBC feed, but we actually had little TVs, like our buddy, if you had an American Express card or something, like you could have a TV and you could be watching stuff going on in other holes, so that helped as well.
Yeah, well, on the Bubba Watson topic, let me just say, you guys are doing the Lord's work. To the ongoing Bubba Salt. You're my heroes. I just love the pray for Tim Scott. The content is so deserved and so good. I just think it's awesome.
It amazes me how much it keeps going. Like, I keep expecting it to stop, and then like I'll be at work and I'll come back and I'll have like 15 messages on Twitter about something else Bubba just did that I wasn't even aware of. And like, it's amazing. He's a parody of himself at this point. But he gives us so much material, it's impossible not to keep picking on it. But
it's funny, like, okay, so here's a guy named Bubba who's, like, kind of quirky, dresses a little funny, has a pink driver, and hits the crap out of the ball, you know, hits it 350 yards. He, like, just by those, like, four criteria, he is so likable, and he is the absolute opposite of his image. And so it's taken a long time. It's coming back on so hard now because people are finally realizing, wait a second, like this guy is not at all who he thought he was.
But it still amazes me how many fans he has and how often I get the reaction. What? You guys are called No Laying Up. You don't like Bubba Watson? How could you not like the guy? He's a free spirit. I'm like, just pay any kind of attention to him at all. And it's kind of like, it's just embarrassing that I read someone posted, I can't get credit to who posted, someone said, that Bubba's cheers were outweighing Rory's cheers this week at Ridgewood. It's like, that alone just states that, like, how dumb some Americans are. Like, it blows my mind as to what the kind of things that people appreciate. He carries himself like he's an everyman. He wears a $500,000 watch and treats everyone around him like shit. Let's just call it like it is. I mean, honestly, at this point, I want him on the leaderboard just because I want him to keep giving us this material. Like, it's so entertaining to me.
the guy's got no filter. We don't have to rehash the whole long drive thing, but I went up to the kids who were, you know, on the tee, on the 10th tee, where the long drive competition was being held, and I knew I was going to get good stuff because they're really nice kids, so I started by saying, you know, who's your favorite golfer that you've seen today? You know, this was late in the day. And they're like, oh, we really liked, you know, Ricky Fowler and Keegan Bradley. And, you know, they came through with Phil and they were all having a really good time. And they were, you know, betting with each other and they were really nice. And I said, well, you know, who's your least favorite golfer? And I had not finished the sentence before both of them were like, Bubba, he's an asshole.
Yes. A new generation.
The young generation is getting it. Not only did he pull the stuff you heard about, he was also swearing at all the staff there. He was like literally swearing, and he was mad that somebody had jumped ahead of them on the practice tee, and he was going, this is fucking bullshit, and like,
oh my God.
Yeah, just throwing a tantrum around these like kids who, you know, who knows, like before the tournament, they might have been huge Bubba fans. The guy just has he has no self-awareness, and it is just endlessly fascinating to watch him, you know, stick his foot farther and farther down his own mouth. Amazing.
I'll tell you a quick story. This was back at the 2012 Memorial Tournament. I was out watching during the Pro-Am, and Bubba hits number eight, like a par three. He hits a shot way left into the crowd and tour sauces it, does the wayward point, and like starts going back and bitching to Ted Scott. I can't even focus, man. All these cameras, I can't even focus. This is a Pro-Am. Remember this. This is a Pro-Am. So he's, I got, and I'm sitting in front row, like, watching this, and I'm with a friend of mine. We just kind of look at each other, like, does he think this counts for something? And then, so we followed him up to the green, watched him finish out. We went and watched the tee off on 9, which is a par 4, and he hits iron off of it. It's like a 412-yard par 4 through the chute. Hits iron, and he hits it kind of, like, strangely fat or off the toe, and it goes straight. It's kind of an okay shot, but it didn't look very pure at all. And there's a small group of people around the tee, and no one really claps or does anything because, again, it's a pro-am. He, while he's getting the tee out of the ground, he just sarcastically goes, nice shot, Bubba. Thanks, everybody. And, like, picks his tee up and just starts walking. And we, like, even people that didn't know that were standing around, were, like, looking at each other, like, was he serious? Did he want us to cheer for him during the pro-am? And, like, I was videoing it. I have all this on video. And, like, that was kind of when the tide turned for me, especially. I mean, I already didn't like the guy. I was like, all right, this guy is really the worst.
Well, I got good news for you, Chris, though. He has said he's come out. He's trying to be a better man and a better Christian. So we can all stop worrying, you know.
It is the year. It's the year of rejoicing. That's what he said. It's the year of rejoicing. I also want to know how somebody who's tweeted almost 50,000 times claims to have deleted the internet off his phone. I don't even know what that means, first of all, to delete the internet off your phone, or if it's physically possible.
No, that was he said that at the British Open. I was there when he said that. Yeah, I don't. Who knows what it means? And somebody followed up, and he was like, oh, yeah, check it sometimes, but, like, not all the time. I think what got me to follow you on Twitter, when I first saw you, somebody retweeted, it was, I forget what you said, but it was Bubba making an ass of himself, but then you added the hashtag year of rejoicing after it, and I just died, because it was so perfect. Like, it's just such a funny phrase, and it's so, like, highfalutin and such nonsense, because Bubba is such a baby. So I was like, I'm going to do this tweet, but I got to follow them right now.
I don't I can't take credit. I can take credit for Pray for Ted Scott. I can't take credit for Year of Rejoicing. I think I got that from, I don't know that, Brendan Porath was from SB Nation. I think that's where I got that from. So, I can't take credit for that. But when he said that, I'd love that, too. It's about rejoicing. You know, the whole year is about rejoicing. But.
Yeah, we're in the midst, we're at the end of the Year of Rejoicing, where he won't do a long drive contest for the charity, which, by the way, is like Christianity and charity are Bubba's sword and shield. They're his defense against his own, like, you know, dick behavior. That's the thing he trots out. And then here we have a charity thing where he could have won, you know, $25,000 for his own charity, and he won't do it. Yeah,
oh,
very funny.
God. It's the best. But so you said that the 2012 Ryder Cup was the first event, or first best golf event you covered. How did you start get in with Grantland? How did you start with the role you currently have, you know, writing about golf for Grantland? You write other stuff for Grantland too as well, right?
Yeah, so I'll give you the short version of the story. I went to school at Duke, and so I was a big college basketball fan. I moved to New York City after graduating, and was trying. I was an English major, so I was trying to write novels, trying to write short stories, trying to be published and all that stuff. So basically, but I also had to have a day job because New York City is very, very expensive. So I think like 3 years, like fast forward 4 years of doing nothing, being totally unproductive, like on the road to being a loser with like no hope and no, you know, no prospects. But I decided, like, I'm like, look, I'm every day at work, which was a cancer center. I was a secretary at a cancer center in New York City. And was like, I need something to do because I sit around all day and do nothing. And get paid way too much for doing it. So I was like, all right, I'm going to start a blog. So I started a Duke basketball blog, and that kind of, it led to some other journalism, vaguely journalistic things in New York. And at a certain point, I was like, all right, you know, I need to go back to school. So I applied to UNC to go back to the North Carolina area and got like a little mini fellowship there. So my girlfriend at the time, who is now my wife, we moved to North Carolina, and I was at the journalism program covering the ACC tournament for this little, like, digital news startup they were trying to do. And I wrote for my Duke blog that I had started in New York, I wrote this piece about how terrible the media relations were at the ACC tournament, how stupid it was. Like, the relationships between the media and the coaches and the media and the players were very superficial, and nobody was really trying hard, and it was just getting, like, this just creating boring relationships, creating boring stories. So anyway, this post, for whatever reason, just went viral. Like, it was picked up everywhere. John Feinstein, Tim Layden, Bill Simmons, they all wrote to me because they got their hands on the story somehow. Wow. So with Simmons, we wrote back and forth a little bit, and this was in March of whatever year it was, I guess 2011. And Grantland was going to start that summer. So that summer I was interning at the Charlotte Observer for no money, which was there, the Charlotte newspaper. And I was like, you know what, let me, Grantland starting, let me write something about the NBA Finals, which was Dallas and Miami that year, and I'll send it to him. And so I sent him this thing, and he's like, oh, I like this, let me share it with my editors. The editors got it, accidentally copied me on an email. One of the editors was like, I didn't really like this, I didn't think it was very good, but... but I read his blog and thought it was kind of funny, so let's give him a shot at the blog. And so basically they had this idea that they were going to do this blog feature, which was a nightly recap. And they said, okay, you have a chance, you have 3 days to have your audition, basically, to do this nightly recap in sports. Do whatever you want. You make it your own, make it funny, do it, you know, make it your own thing. And we'll let you know after these 3 days. And in the afternoon, do a post about anything you want. So for the next 3 days, I'm running back and forth to the Charlotte Observer, pretending to be sick so I can run home and write, you know, write a post for Grantland, and doing this kind of stuff, doing the nightly recap, auditioning for it at the same time, which I didn't know. But anyway, at the end of it, they thought some of the stuff I'd written was funny, so they gave me a little contract to do the feature that became About Last Night, which was the, you know, the...
Yep.
The nightly review of sports, which was basically, I turned it into like an Onion style satirical jokey thing, and did that for about a year. Well, I did some other stuff, which was mostly baseball and college basketball. And then 2012 came around, and Grown had no interest in golf. It's a little too cool for golf at that time, you know. And so I begged them. I said, please, please, please send me to the Ryder Cup. The Ryder Cup is like, you know, as we've discussed, like, even if you don't like golf, the Ryder Cup is the greatest thing ever. It's got, you know, elements of patriotism and history and everything. It's so cool. So please send me there. And so I begged and begged and begged, and finally they said yes. And one of the first things I did there, Bill Murray was in the first ever Ryder Cup Pro-Am that they had. So I followed Bill Murray around. I wrote a thing about that. I wrote a preview, and then I wrote a feature on the Monday after about Ian Poulter and everything he had done. And which I guess Bill Simmons really liked, and so they, you know, they said, fine, you know, you can cover the majors from now on if you can get credentials. And so that was supposed to be the short version, but it turned long. But that's how I got into the golf beat for Grantland.
That's great. I mean, we've poked fun at Grantland in the past for kind of dropping the ball on golf coverage. Granted, we're a golf blog, so we only really pay attention to golf, but. No, it's good to see Grantland kind of getting on board slowly and covering golf. It's not the same, you know, excitement level that it was when Tiger was first busting on the scene or whatever, but there's a ton going on in the golf world now. We've had a really slow season, but, you know, the majors have kind of saved us. The worthy champions we've had in the majors this year have kind of made it. They picked some good events to cover this year, I guess. We're going to talk about the majors. They haven't been the most exciting, but they've at least, you know, Bubba winning a second major, as much as we don't like him, it's a pretty big story. What Rory did in the second half of this year is obviously a huge story. So, you know, that's good. That's good to hear. Good to see that Grantland is up in their golf games. And sending you to Scotland, that is awesome.
Yeah, well, and actually, I'm writing a book this year, and so I've been to about 30 tournaments at this point. I think it's 30 the number now. So I've been the whole year, yeah. I'm writing, an agent contacted me when he saw some of my Grantland stuff, so I'm writing a book about the young players on the tour and kind of what life after Tiger is like, so that's going to come out next year. So yeah, I've been to all of them, man, and I agree with you. I think it's, you know, we haven't had a Tiger presence this year, but I think it's been a pretty exciting year anyway, with some pretty cool, even the minor tournaments have been some pretty cool stories, and then just watching Rory do what he's done, and even Martin Keimer earlier in the year, and it's just been pretty neat.
Yeah, I always say, I mean, I you probably agree, I'd rather Tiger sit out a tournament than do what he's done this year when he shows up and he's hurt and kind of distracts from the actual tournament and the actual good storylines that are going on. I think, for me personally, I like when he's not in a tournament, how the focus shifts away from him. When he's in a tournament and he's 15 shots off the pace and they're showing every shot of his, That detracts from the coverage for me, you know. So, I'd obviously rather win five tournaments a year like he did last year, But I'd also rather him be out injured than out there trying to play and kind of taking away from the overall viewer experience. But did you make it to the Memorial this year?
No, you know, that was one of the few I skipped, and it was just the timing of it. And it was just, yeah, because I forget the schedule, but I had been to, like, was it the Texas tournaments maybe before, right, that were right before it I had been to? And so I was driving back, and I would have had to fly to Ohio or something. And I was like, yeah, you know what, forget it. I'm just gonna do the next one. Yeah, well, one thing I will say is that with Tiger, what's interesting is that when he came back at the Congressional, his whole thing was like, you know, like, oh, the doctors are amazed I'm coming back so fast, and people who have had the same, you know, this same spinal issue, this back issue that I've had, are totally amazed that I'm coming back. It kind of proved that he came back too soon. I mean,
yeah,
he was a bit of a disaster this year. And so it's like, you know, Tiger at his best is a huge addition to golf, but Tiger, this version of Tiger is just an annoying distraction, and right up into including the process before the Ryder Cup, where all of a sudden he wanted Tom to pick him, and you're like, wait a second, why would Tom Watson ever pick you?
Yeah, and you can't sit out 3 months after a back surgery. Like, you got surgery, you were supposed to cure this injury, right? You can't come back and be hurt after that. Like, you can't, like, there's no in between there. You come back when you're healthy. Right? I hate when people accuse others of faking injuries. I don't think he's faking it. I think he way overplayed the back part for the PGA and the Bridgestone. Because, like he said, there was nothing related to his surgery at all. It wasn't where he had the surgery. It wasn't pain that. And with how hurt he was at Bridgestone, you can't possibly play the PGA. You could barely walk after that. And as somebody that's battled back injuries, you don't bounce back from that in 3 days. Like, I felt like it was a little theatrical, that whole thing. I hate saying that, but I really did feel that way.
Yeah, it was. It was just like, it distracted from everything else. We had some amazing tournaments. Like, the Bridgestone in Akron, I mean, that was one of the best tournaments of the year so far. And one of the most revealing when you saw what Rory did to Sergio on Sunday. And it's like, geez, we gotta focus on Tiger right now. Like, come on. They're like, golf is moving on, guys. You like, get on board, you know?
Yeah. Well, tell me a little bit more about what your book is about, what you mean by post-Tiger. Because we actually have a piece that's getting ready to run, I think probably on Friday, about one of our guys, Phil, did a deep dive into how much money Tiger is responsible for putting in the bank accounts of other PGA Tour players. So I was interested to see what you thought about what you said about golf life after Tiger.
Yeah, well, that's great to hear, because I'm sure I will. You know, I'd love to steal some of that research for the book when it comes out. But no, you know, it's basically, do you know the book A Good Walk Spoiled by John Feinstein? I think it was published in 1994.
I've not read it, but I'm familiar with it, yeah.
Yeah, so the idea there was just, it's just a season on the PGA Tour. He's following around a number of guys. And on a very simple level, that's what I proposed. That's what me, myself and my agent proposed this year. Like, look, we've got Tiger Woods kind of getting toward the twilight of his career. You know, Phil Mickelson, you could argue the same, even though they're both still very capable of winning tournaments. But we thought we could identify 2014 as a year where it's going to be a transitional year. The young guys are going to start winning a lot. The game is going to start to turn, and we're going to start to see new personalities emerge. And the timing, we thought, would be perfect for somebody to be there all season to find out what these guys are really like, to talk to them, to write a book that's about these guys, where they came from, what happens on the course this year, what happens off the course, and just sort of be tell-all is the wrong word, but a sort of just a piece about what life is like on the tour right now and who these guys are. So that's the basic premise. And, you know, the nut version of it is, Good Walk Spoiled for the New Generation, as well as a treatise on what happens after Tiger Woods and the PGA Tour. What can we expect when Tiger's no longer the dominant force that he was? And I really think that it's been an amazing year. I'm really, really, really excited about this book. If people go to Grantland and read some of the stuff I've written, if you like that style, it's going to be like that, except better, because I withheld stuff, because I don't want people to hate me yet, because I want them to talk to me before the book is published. So, you know, it's like, but there's going to be a lot of great stuff there. And, I think if you're not a golf fan, and you've probably run into this, Chris, like, people's perception of golf, because it's like, oh, it's this boring rich person's game. Well, I'll tell you what, that's not true at all. It's, you know, there may be some rich people in it, but it's not boring. It is a game that is so incredibly anxiety-provoking that you get this assortment of personalities, from lunatics to obsessives to you know, just every kind of oddball and weirdo you can imagine. And these guys are just fascinating. And the way their personalities dictate what happens on the course is just a drama that I could witness over and over, and I love writing about it, and I just think it's going to be such an exciting book when it comes out.
Well, it's the most unique sport, in my opinion, just because it's the most individual sport. I mean, people compare it to tennis as far as, like, you know, be individual tennis players, but in golf, you are always playing the golf course. So you're basically playing yourself. So there's nothing that an opponent, other than, like, put pressure on you by hitting a good shot, there's nothing an opponent can do to defend you. Like, it's, you're not playing, even in match play, you're not playing against your opponent. You and your opponent are playing the same hole, and whoever gets the lowest score wins the hole. So it's truly just the most, it's not a testament of, like in tennis, you can just kind of physically dominate another player, or you can beat him with strategy and whatnot, but you're playing against that other player. Golf is just truly a test of how everyone plays the golf course that day. And you are so much in, on your own. The biggest thing these guys' teams are, like, sports psychologist, trainer, caddy, swing coach, short game coach, you know, as much as it's, you're still on your own. Like, it is, you on your own. So it's like, when I thought about Tiger firing Foley this week and thought about, you know, he's got a decision to make, it's like, it's Tiger's decision to who he's going to trust with his swing. There's no head coach that's going to decide who, like, is Tiger's going to work with next. Like, you are just in charge of everything. And I've got a friend of mine that plays on tour, and it's kind of surprised me as I've gotten to know him better about just what tour life is like. And I think you're probably getting an interesting insight into that. I think it's probably completely different now than it was 25 years ago, where I feel like a lot of those guys were good friends and would go out and drink beers with each other after rounds. Now I feel like even more, the game's become more, just even more of an individual game. These guys, you know, are going straight to the gym after a round, before a round, and it's turned into these 10, 12, 13-hour days. Whereas golf kind of used to just be something where you'd show up and play. These guys were so talented. Not saying those guys didn't work hard, but the competition level has just kind of changed, and Tiger's probably to blame or credit for a lot of that.
Yeah, and the money's changed too. You know, I actually asked Henrik Stenson about that today. He had his press conference, and I said, you know, what's the difference? The question that led to it was, what's the difference between a European player and an American player? And he kind of riffed on, like, what's the difference between the European Tour and the PGA Tour? Well, in the European Tour, the money is low enough still that it still retains some of that sort of camaraderie, or whatever you want to call it, where people, you know, players will go out and hang out. They're all in the same hotel. They're taking shuttle buses together to the course. They're going out and having a drink after. PGA Tour, man, everybody's got a private car. A lot of people have their family there. Like you said, everybody's got a team that might consist of your agent, your caddy, your swing coach, your mental coach. And, you know, on and on, there could be a posse of up to like seven people, which I think with the, when we talk about the anxiety that golf provokes in the player, I think they like having a big team around, because it sort of creates at least the illusion that there are other people who can carry part of the load for them. Mm-hmm. Even though there's this grim reality is that you're out there on the course on your own. Nobody else can hit those shots for you. But yeah, and so these guys, like, don't hang out with each other very much. It's just not a thing that happens. There's a lot of isolation there, and it can be very lonely. It can be, now it's lonely for American players. Imagine what it's like, A, for European players, like a young guy like, yeah, Jonas Blix, who's not married, who's out here, who's got nobody to hang out with. Now imagine what it's like for someone like Sung Mul Noh, who doesn't even speak English.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I mean, these guys, there's a lot of loneliness and isolation to the whole thing. And the two things I would add to what you say about golf is that it's a sport where there is no reaction to somebody else. And tennis is an individual sport, but you're always reacting to what somebody else does, or, yep, or trying to influence what somebody else does. Every other sport you can think of, you know, all the team sports, basketball, baseball, football, you're always trying to influence. There's none of that in golf. And the second thing is, there's no sport where you have so much time to think between shots. You know, there is just endless walking and thinking, and it creates the most, it's just like this mental sort of like vice that you have to withstand for an entire round. So yeah, I mean, it's just, it's great. It's a great set of conditions for a sport that you can really look inside the mental state of these players.
It's a game, ultimate game of failure. I mean, I never really thought about it until I read Hank Haney's book about Tiger, just about how golf is controlling misses. And other than the shot that goes in the hole, I mean, obviously there's successful shots that don't go in the hole. You're basically trying not to screw up basically the entire time. I mean, it's just the game has been so associated with failure throughout the years. I mean, you remember the failures, the chokes and the missed putts more than some of the big moments. Growing up, I always thought that the PGA Tour, I've talked about this with Kyle Porter from CBS on our podcast before. I always thought it was so glamorous and the best sports job you could have. And actually, the more I see it up close and personal, the more I think it's 10% as glamorous as it looks. I mean, I said before, you would think the players show up and their clubs are all ironed and pressed in their locker and they're ready to roll. It's like, I picked him up at the airport. He's got five bags with him. He's on the road for 7 weeks. He's carrying his own clubs at the airport. Like those are the kind of things you don't think about. He's up at 5 a.m. ironing his pants that he's going to be on national TV wearing and stuff like that. I just always assumed everything was so easy for these guys, but they do a lot of this stuff by themselves, and they still pay incredible expenses over the course of a year. I mean, it costs so much money you don't know when you're going to fly out of a tournament. I know these guys make a ton of money, but you're talking about a guy that makes maybe $400,000 on the year. When you are paying a caddy $1,500 a week, plus a percentage of your earnings, plus the hotel fees, plus the baggage fees, plus the flights, and last minute flights are not cheap. I mean, money adds up really quickly, and it's not, granted they make sponsorship money too, and they do fine financially, but it's not nearly as profitable of a career as it probably looks like for the middle of the road guys. The top guys are doing just fine.
Don't
worry about them, but, it's not a huge cash grab all the way down the line.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, it's very, very good for the guys at the top, and it's very, very hard to get there. And once you get there, it's very, very hard to stay there. And that's what makes it so fascinating. But yeah, it's a cool, I wouldn't say I was even a huge, huge golf fan. Even when I started covering golf, I was a big golf fan, but I've just become a really big fan over the last couple of years.
Yeah, that's where we kind of came. We've been golf fans for forever, and we've been the guys that we started the website with. Three of us went to college together, and we've always just been like played fantasy golf together and talked about it forever. And we started a Twitter account for it about almost 2 years ago, maybe a year and a half ago. And we got kind of bored with that, and we started the website in January. And it's really hard to do. With four of us that do it, it's hard to do. We all have full-time jobs. And it's hard to constantly, keep putting material up and keep going. But we've had a lot of fun with it. I mean, it's been we just felt like there was kind of a gap in, like, the stories that Golf Digest is reporting on and the guys that are on the beat every week that are reporting on. And we felt like there's a gap, of guys that can just kind of look at golf in a fun, more fun, relaxed way, in a funny way. We don't take it too serious. We're not journalists. Like, we just try to have as much fun with it as possible, and it's been a lot of fun so far, that's for sure.
And that's, an interesting thing about golf, isn't it? Because somewhere along the line, in terms of journalism, it entered this, like, mythical territory where it's this, like, romantic, like, natural game that we must treat as though, it's played by walking saints and everything. And it's funny because I think golf might be like a decade behind every other sport in terms of how people talk about it. Mm-hmm. So now, baseball or basketball or football, we don't deify it. We don't treat it with kid gloves or anything. Golf, it's still very difficult and very revolutionary if you're going to say like, hey, Bubba Watson's a jerk or something like very simple and obvious like that. It's like, whoa, like it's crazy to say something bad about golfers because we're so used to venerating them. And that's why, you guys are great about that. And really, like, I think, with the book, that's what I hope to do is to discuss golf in a very honest way that is hopefully funny at times. I mean, Hunter S. Thompson is one of my heroes. I love the way he writes. And so, just that kind of style of, like, look, what is it? Like, forget all the hero worship stuff that 95% of journalists are doing right now. What is golf really like? What are these guys really like? And it's a new age for golf, and it's funny to watch everybody react. People who have been used to the old way, which is where we treat these guys like they're made of gold or something.
Yep. No, I completely agree. So why don't we let's transition. We floated a couple questions on Twitter, and we got a couple good ones. best one we got, I thought, was from my friend Kyle Porter at CBS, who asked, if you had a four-ball tournament, two players from the same alma mater, so you would form teams of two, you had to have gone to the same college together, who wins that? And I thought it was a fascinating question. I'm not that well-versed in where guys went to college. I know where a lot of the top guys went, but I know why Kyle's asking, because he went to Oklahoma State, and he's probably pretty pumped about Hunter Mahan, Ricky Fowler team right now, but what did you get a chance to think about the question at all? Do you have any idea where you would lean there?
Yeah, I mean, Hunter Mahan and Ricky Fowler is a great pairing. I mean, it really would be. I mean, when you look at it now, they're both going to be on the Ryder Cup. Well, we think Hunter Mahan is.
Yeah.
We're pretty and they're both great match play players. I mean, Ricky Fowler has been a great match play player since his Walker Cup days. The guy, you know, the guy's just good. Although I have a funny story about him. If I can diverge here for a second.
Go for it.
He was playing Brian Harmon in the NCAA match play, Georgia versus Oklahoma State, and it was Harmon's senior year. I'm not sure what year it was for Fowler, but, and this is a story I got from Harmon and from Chris Hack, his coach at Georgia. They were on the 16th green, and Ricky was, let's see, he was one up, and Ricky was in for par already, and Brian Harmon had an eight-footer for par, and Fowler was with his coach, who was Mike McGraw at the time. And they just walked away. They walked to the 17th green before Brian Harmon had even hit his putt. And Brian Harmon, who won for the first time this year, is an incredibly competitive guy. And he saw them go, and he looked at his coach, Chris Hack, and said, we can swear, right? We've determined that we can say whatever we want here.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
We said, they looked at him, and he said, they really just do that? And he goes, I'm going to beat this motherfucker. And so he hits the 8-foot putt, and he goes on and takes the last two holes and beats Ricky Fowler. And later, they asked, and, like, you know, of course they were trying to insult him at all, but that's how Brian Harmon took it at the time, and that's what he did. But anyway, speaking of that, the other team I think would be really good. You have a lot of guys at Georgia, and a lot of them have won this year, but I think in particular they hate each other, but if they could get along, a team of, like, Brendan Todd and Bubba Watson would be great. Because you got Bubba, who's long as hell, and Brendan Todd, who's a great chipper and a putter. I think they would complement each other nicely on that one. I mean, look, if you want to go to the Northeast, you've got Andrew Svoboda and Keegan Bradley from St. John's.
We love Svoboda here. Back in February, Neil, one of our guys, was at Pebble Beach. And I think he'd had a couple adult beverages, and Svoboda crushed a ball on 18, but it was like into the wind or something. And Neil yelled at him to not make sure he doesn't lay up on that second shot. And Svoboda like looked at him and was like, all right, that sounds good. And like Neil had no idea at the time, but he was like 12 over on the round. Like we had no idea. And he would have never yelled that at him if he didn't know that. But like, Svoboda was so cool about it. He responded. He's like, all right, I'll go for it. I think he either hit driver off the deck or three wood and went for it. He didn't get there, but he made like his only par of the back nine or only birdie of the back nine. So we've been huge Svoboda fans ever since then. So I know you're trying to make a little joke there, but we got Svoboda's back.
Yeah, no, Svoboda. I mean, Svoboda's come legit close to winning a couple times this year.
Yeah, he's had a really good year.
Now, I might be totally wrong about this, but did Furyk and Mickelson both go to Arizona State, or am I way off?
I think Furyk went to Arizona.
And Mickelson, Arizona State?
Mickelson for sure went to Arizona State. I think Furyk went to Arizona. Pat Perez, I know, went to Arizona State.
Perez and Mickelson. So that would have been a great one, but that's no good. Let's see, you could have Billy Horschel and Matt Everys from Florida.
You could do another Georgia team. You could do Harris English and what's his name? Could be Brian Harmon. There's someone else I'm forgetting too from Georgia.
Yeah, well, you have Russell Henley. You have
Pat
Green was there. He's not an alum, but he was there for a little while. That didn't work out too well, but he was there. Let's see. You have Brendan Todd. You have Harris English. Yeah, those Georgia guys have been unbelievable this year.
Yeah, Trevor from Tap In Golf chimed in as well. I'll see Tiger and Michelle Wee, assuming she gets to play the normal women's tees.
That's good. That's really good.
That's spot on. That's a hell of a team. That may take the whole thing. Well, as soon as we got this question, I thought about putting a bracket together for just for the event in Boston and put it in. Just like throwing their four ball scores in afterward and seeing how it played out for one weekend. I thought that might be kind of interesting.
But that'd be awesome. Yeah. You also have to think about who are some Texas guys? Who would play with Jordan Spieth?
See, this is where my lack of knowledge on where guys went to school. I know that Ben Crenshaw went there.
I don't know any Texas guys either, but yeah, someone could be with Spieth. But yeah, no, that would be cool. It would also be cool to do that to see, like, you know, like, the guy who won the tournament could be out the first day, you know what I mean, based on his four-ball scores on Thursday or Friday in this case.
Okay. All right, another question we got. This is from Lifebeater. What is the second best club to use as a putter to finish a round? I think you said he's asking for a friend.
Well, that's a reference. I don't know if you caught this, but that's a reference to a story that somehow only I got, and it was because I was staying at an Airbnb in Akron with this Canadian who had followed Jason Duffner around. And Saturday, Duffner was so frustrated with his putting that he gave his putter away to a kid on the 12th hole. Well, he gave his putter away, and he putted the rest of the round, he putted with a 3-wood. And nobody knew this. The rest
I know.
Of the game, like, Twitter references, and so I heard it from this guy and was like, you guys, no, that's not true, you gotta be kidding. And so I went to Duffner on Sunday, and he was miserable because he's hurt and he's not having a good time. Listen, Jason, I heard you take your putter away, I just want to make sure that's true. And he's like, yep. This guy wanted to do anything but talk to me at that moment, so I was trying to keep the questions quick, and so I was like, well, you know, what hole was it? He's 12. What did you putt with? And he goes, 3-wood. Anything else you want to say? He goes, nope.
That's a strange one to me. I would have thought driver. So me and some buddies of mine, we go on a trip every year up to Michigan, up to, it's called the Boyne Cup. We play it up in Boyne, Michigan. And we play 36 holes a day, and we stay on a court right in a house right on a golf course. And so after we finish 36, one of the nights we'll go out and we'll play two-man best ball night golf, just in the complete dark. So you can only bring 3 clubs. You can use cell phone lights, but you can't bring 3 clubs. So that's part of the strategy is what you got to figure out what you're going to putt with. So I always bring a driver, a wedge, and a 7-iron, and I putt with the driver. And it works pretty well. You just keep the putter, like, you don't lift it off the ground. I just, like, drag it on the ground and putted it out. Granted, I can barely see the ball. So that's what I always use. We had an epic playoff this year where you can't even see the pin where you're putting it. And we were making 20-foot putts in the dark, and we had a few adult beverages with it. And a guy, an 18 handicapper, made about a 40-foot putt to have a hole. Ran in the bunker and was doing sand angels in the bunker, screaming from the top of his lungs. So I'm going to have to leave it driver. Driver would be the club I would go to finish out a round if I lost my putter somehow.
Oh, that's great. That's terrific.
So, all right. Trevor, our friend Trevor at Tapping Golf, he gave Bacon and I a great question a couple weeks ago when we did the podcast. We'll start with that one, then we'll go to his question this week. So the question was, if you had to permanently wear one of these two, and the audio of Bacon and I's podcast for this part got cut out, unfortunately, so a lot of this, what we said, went unheard, but if you had to permanently do one of the two, either wear permanent clown makeup or permanently wear clown clothes, what would you choose?
So it's either clown makeup or clown clothes?
You had to permanently wear one of the two.
Yeah, I think that's easy. I would definitely wear clown clothes over clown makeup because... Yeah. You could, is there wiggle, like, what kind of wiggle room is there? You could even kind of get stylish, I think, with clown clothes. Whereas, like, clown makeup, you know, you're just terrifying everybody all the time. You look like a weird, like, John Wayne Gacy pedophile serial killer as you walk around.
Yeah, and that's what, so I said the same thing. The answer is pretty easy. It's clothes. But the reasoning why people would do it, I thought was hilarious to me. I lost a bet. I have to wear clown clothes, whatever. When I talked about it with Bacon, he said, you know, yeah, you could be talking to a girl at the bar. You could be like, yeah, I just got off work. So he was going to go with the as if he was a clown. Like, that was going to be his lie. He was going to say that he actually was a clown. He'd be like, yeah, you know, if the girl sneezes, you could, like, pull the handkerchief out of your sleeve and whatnot. And I just absolutely lost it. I was like, we decided whenever we play, the loser is going to have to dress up, going to have to wear clown clothes to the bar after the round. Those are the stakes when we play.
Well, yeah, there's nothing women like more than clown. You know, the kind of people who perform at kids' birthday parties.
All right, so Trevor's question this week was, and I got to be honest, I don't really understand the difference, or I don't really understand the question that well, but can a ghost and a zombie come from the same person?
So the zombie would be, yeah, you die and you come back to life with your own body, whereas a ghost is you die as like a corporeal sort of spirit. That's a great question, actually. That's a terrific question from Trevor.
Are we just assuming we're going full hype, like fantasy story world here, clearly, right? Like a TV show.
You're lying, like, let's say you're lying on a slab, like you're dead, right? You die. Two things are happening at once. Your soul is leaving your body and you're becoming a ghost and you're haunting, but at the same time, what's left of your body, minus the soul, is turning into a zombie. So I would say that the answer is yes, and here's my reasoning. Because a zombie is commonly understood, like in The Walking Dead and everything else, the soul is not present in the body. Because, like, you see them, and, like, it's like there's that moment where the eyes go vacant, and then the next thing takes over. You're reanimated by, like, the brain, which is no longer you. So you can have that without the soul, whereas a ghost is, like, 100% soul. Like, it's the soul with unfinished business. Like, you know, oh, it's like somebody... He killed me and nobody knows it, so I've got to haunt them until they know it. So I think you can have a zombie walking around in your old body, whereas, like, your soul is the ghost. And I have to think that the soul is, like, or the ghost is a little bit annoyed at the zombie. Like, Jesus, like, cool down a little. I've got a real mission to do here.
Like, have you seen the movie Ghost, the 80s movie Ghost?
Was that the one with Patrick Swayze?
It is, yeah.
I've seen it, but a long time ago. I barely remember it.
So I've got a buddy of mine who is he's kind of a hard ass. Like he's a tough guy. He'll always rip on you. He's just a rough around the edges kind of guy. But for whatever reason, when it comes to movies, he cries at everything. I mean, like if it's an emotional episode of a TV show, he will cry. And like that's his one weakness. He embraces it though. Anyways, Ghost is like, I think, personally, like just a cheesy 80s movie. Like, it doesn't really hit you emotionally. I mean, yeah, it's about a girl whose, like, boyfriend or husband dies, and he's, like, you know, there's a plot there to it, but it's just kind of a cheesy movie. We're watching the end of Ghost, and I'm kind of laughing about just the special effects that they had in the 80s and the music and whatnot, the cheesiness. And I look over, and he's just bawling. He has lost it to the final scene of Ghost, of Patrick Swayze's Ghost. I've never let him hear the end of that.
What's the song? That was tip of my tongue. What's the song that, like, the emotional, like, climax song of Ghost?
Oh, man.
It's like, all I can think of is, like, the I Had the Time of My Life song, but it's not similar. Oh, man. Anyway.
I just Googled it. It's, is it Oh My Love? Is that it? No. I don't know the answer to this.
Anyway, yeah, the image will become even funnier if you picture, like, your friend bawling to it.
I don't know if I can really follow up from your answer. I can't. I don't watch The Walking Dead, but I didn't think about it until you said, like, a zombie to me does not have a soul. So that would make sense that the soul would leave the body, the ghost haunts, like, and can't be seen, but the zombie physically haunts you. Does that sound right?
Yeah, no, totally. I don't think they work in tandem. I think the ghost is a little snug. The ghost thinks it's, like, really way better than the zombie, and the zombie's just, like, the stupid kid, like, like the idiot frat boy of the spirit world.
The ghost is for sure a hipster. There's no doubt.
Totally.
So I think we've definitely appealed to any golf fans that are also ghost and zombie fans, and I think we've run you an hour, so I'm going to let you go. But thanks a ton for joining me. I've been wanting to do this for a while. It's fun. Everyone, thanks for tuning in. This was Shane Ryan from Grantland.com. We'll definitely do this again, maybe post Ryder Cup, or if I don't talk to you before then, have fun in Scotland, man. Enjoy.
Yeah, sounds good, Chris. Thanks very much for having me on, man.
You bet. Take care, everyone. Thanks.
Be the right club. Be the right club today.
Yes! Johnny, that's better than most.
How about him?
That is better than most. Better than most!